Hey everyone, welcome to Exploring Health, Macro to Micro. I'm your host, Parker Condit. In this show, I interview health and wellness experts around topics like sleep, exercise, nutrition, stress management, mental health, and much more. So by the end of each episode, you'll have concrete, tangible advice that you can start implementing today to start living a healthier life, either for yourself or for your loved ones. And that's the micro side of the show. The macro side of the show is discussing larger systemic issues that contribute to health outcomes. And today's episode is a nice balance between the micro and macro. Today's primary focus is on mental health, and here to discuss that with me is Melody Murray. Melody is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a child mental health specialist. She's also a former reality TV producer and director and was a stand-up comedian for 5 years. In this episode, we go over the 5-4-3-2-1 rule, what to do in the case of a panic attack, the relationship between discomfort, fear, and personal growth, how our minds can trick us and how we give more weight to negative experiences, how addiction runs in the family, and why environment is such an important factor in that, and we discuss the foundations of vulnerability. Finally, Melody is also an author. Towards the end of the episode, we talk about her inaugural book, Mourning the Living, When the Loved One You've Lost is Still Here. Her second book, My Bounce Back Plan, Designing Your Own Healing Formula, was released on March 15th. This is a workbook that is meant to grow with you as you go through loss and challenges in life. It's available on her website and Amazon, both of which will be linked in the show notes and description. So without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Melody Murray. Melody, thanks so much for being here. We're just going to dive right into the first question. How do you define, or what do you think is the foundation of vulnerability?
I think vulnerability is the ability to be authentic. And that's a luxury. I believe vulnerability is a luxury. You have to have a certain level of variables in play for you to feel comfortable being authentic. You've got to feel safe. You got to feel secure. You've got to know that there's someone that is listening to you and they see you and they hear you and they respect you. Vulnerability is not an easy thing to do.
When you said there's a variety of variables, the first word that came to mind was safety. So I'm glad you listed that off. My follow-up to that was going to be along the lines of, is this something that you can do? Like, does this have to come from within yourself? Or can you, like, if you don't have all of the requisite variables in place to be vulnerable, can you look externally to other people to sort of help facilitate that sort of environment, if you will?
This is such a great question. And it's so important because I think that in order to be vulnerable, trust has to be present as well. And what makes vulnerability difficult is when we grow up in environments where we can't trust the environment. We can't trust the people that are in control. We can't trust, you know, what's going on because there's chaos. And so we are taught early on that we can't trust people that are in control of our environments. And so we can carry that on. You know, vulnerability does require trust, but I think that what can crack that is whenever you do encounter people that are just genuinely kind and they are repeatedly kind and you let that chip away at your fear of being trusting of other people. You use that evidence to chip away at all that was taught to you about what it means to open up to other people and to be vulnerable around other people. And you let that become your new evidence of, hey, I can relax now. I can actually share with this person. They've given me the space to be me. They've given me the space to be honest about how I think and how I feel. And, oh, maybe I can trust. Maybe I can be vulnerable. And that has come externally.
Okay. So until you have that externally, do you see as a therapist that do you see people turn inward? So a trust has not been facilitated outwardly through a home environment or through an upbringing. Do those people turn inwardly almost too much? And they're like, I'm the only one I can trust. I'm the only one that's reliable.
Yeah. And there's that, you know, hyper independence comes from that, where you've been, because of your experiences, you've been taught through your experiences that you can't rely on anybody else. And so you don't reach your hand out. You don't ask for help because you've been burned so many times before. So yes, there is a tendency to then just only rely on yourself and think that you can't rely on other people. But, you know, a part of that, you know, needing to trust other people, a part of that is like we need to trust ourselves too. So I think that whenever you need to build up the ability to be vulnerable, it should start with yourself. It should start with yourself and maybe backtracking, you know, your life choices and decisions thus far. You know, what decisions have you made that have gotten you to where you are that you're happy about? Where you live, who your friends are, what your jobs have been, your education. You know, remembering that you were a big part of making the decisions to getting you to where you are right now, that can help you build your self-confidence and your self-trust. And then once we build up that self-trust, then we can extend that to other people if we choose to do so, which I think is a good idea, or else you're going to live a lonely life. And we're not supposed to be on our own. We're not supposed to be lonely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was curious, when you start talking about trust and that it can come from sort of external sources, or that's a way that you can facilitate it if you didn't necessarily grow up in the environment where there's sort of mutual trust both ways in a relationship or in an environment. If that can sort of be a bridge in the meantime until you can start to sort of build that trust within yourself. Does it go both ways? Like, ideally, you're trusting in yourself and you can trust in others, but are there ways where people who only trust themselves, they then start branching outwardly, and those who only sort of facilitate that safety through external environments, can they then sort of come back to themselves? Because that's what, without actually knowing any of this stuff, I'm like, that sounds healthy if you can do it both ways.
You know, and that's the goal. You know, that is the goal. But I think that we have to start small. We've got to take baby steps when it comes to doing this and be really patient with yourself as you're challenging yourself, because that's what you're doing. You're challenging yourself. You're challenging what you were taught to think about yourself. You're challenging what you were taught to think about the world. And those challenges are really, really necessary. But, you know, you also have to be patient with yourself and know that it's okay to feel clueless. It's okay to feel comfortable. And you really need to accept being uncomfortable in your journey to heal yourself. You have to be uncomfortable. If you want anything to change, you have to be uncomfortable. You know, I tell my clients all the time that, you know, the very beginning of us working together, I'll say to them, like, nobody goes to the gym until their pants are too tight. You have to be uncomfortable for change sometimes. It would be amazing if it was internal, you know, you had this internal motivator and you're like, yes, I'm going to do this. And I know all the things. Everybody knows what it takes to lose weight, but nobody's doing it. Everybody knows eat less, exercise more. And how many obese people do we have in this country? So we have to challenge ourselves. And a part of that challenge is being uncomfortable. And that discomfort sometimes comes in us letting other people in and us allowing ourselves to think differently about things that were drilled into us. This is how you think, and this is how you're supposed to be. This is what a man is supposed to be, and this is what a woman is supposed to be. Open yourself up to challenge those things. And sometimes those challenges can come internally, and sometimes it comes from conversations from other people. We just have to be open to realize that not everybody's trying to attack you.
Yeah, so I'm glad you made the reference to something fitness related or weight loss related, because I used to be a personal trainer. So that's sort of the world that's one of my main worldviews that I can always reference. And then, yeah, you mentioned the discomfort piece, where a lot of people, if they say they want to make a change, they are point A, they want to get to point B, but the pain isn't necessarily high enough. So it's always about exposing, like using graded exposure to get them, like what's necessary to get them to point B. Like, they don't have the capacity, the work capacity, the desire to go to the gym, the amount, the time to dedicate to it. So I need to set like intermediate goals for them in the meantime, be like, this is what your capacity is. So I'm going to get you to here to sort of keep you on the treadmill, if you will, towards your goal. So I guess from like a mental health or therapy standpoint, can you give a few examples of like, what are these small things of people who aren't And I don't even know if it's a good idea to dive into the deep end when you're trying to do these things. Like, what are some small things that people can do to start either rebuilding trust or becoming more vulnerable with themselves and with others?
Take it day by day. You know, baby steps are a great way to go. And, you know, one simple thing you can do is look at yesterday. Look at yesterday. What did you eat yesterday? Did you wake up with your alarm when you wanted to? Did you go to bed when you said you wanted to? Pat yourself on the back when you did the things that you wanted to do, simple things. You know, and sometimes when people are really, really in tough spots, I say, did you take a shower? Pat yourself on the back. Did you brush your teeth? Hell yeah, you brushed your teeth. Keep it simple. You know, so many people think like, you know, a move towards improvement is like, I cured cancer today. I lifted the car off the baby. Stop. It doesn't have to be some big grand gesture. Simple stuff, and build on the really simple things. And then you can realize that, hey, I can trust myself. And then when something doesn't happen the way you want, know that you can start again 5 minutes from now. You don't even have to wait until tomorrow. You can start over again 5 minutes from now.
Right. The day's not over. You can still get small wins in before the end of the day.
It's funny. Celebrate the wins. You know, it's a really important thing to celebrate the wins, because some people grew up in households where nothing was celebrated. They only got attention when something went wrong. And so that is work. That is work, but it's simple work, but it's necessary work to celebrate little wins and then celebrate the big stuff too. But take a pause to really be grateful for the improvements that you're making.
I think there's some idea in psychology that people mentally weight negative experiences heavier than positive experiences. Is that true?
Not all brains are built that way, but many are.
Okay. Yeah, I read it was like, I think 3 to 7, like you need 3 to 7 positive experiences for every one negative experience or thought. So just keeping that in mind, it's very important to not undermine the small wins throughout the day, because if you've got a few of them, but you're not really paying attention to them, and then one negative thing happens, that day is probably going to be framed in a negative light in your mind, unless you're giving the appropriate weight to those positive small wins, even if they are small.
So true. So extremely true. And I think that, you know, we can have a tendency to, I mean, we're in a victim society right now where, you know, obviously, you know, people are litigious and people are pissy about a lot of different things. And, you know, I get it. I get it. I'm a part of the world too. But I think that you have to be careful with yourself that if something doesn't go your way, that you don't then go, well, I got a flat tire. Then I was late to work. And then my boyfriend pissed me off. And then the dog peed on the carpet. And then, you know, that piling on. And a lot of times we do the pile on because we want to tell a story. We want to throw it on social media and go, look at me, look at me. And it's like, stop. You know, what we put our energy into builds. Whatever we put our energy into builds, which I think is a really tough thing, that just to swing it out, you know, out a little bit, where people go, I'm going to hope for the best, but plan for the worst. Honey, whatever you plan for is what you're going to get. Wherever you put your energy, that is what's going to grow. So you have to be really mindful of where you're putting your energy. So you have to make sure that if something bad happens, it's just that one thing, that one bad thing that happened. It doesn't mean you're cursed. Chill out, dust yourself off, and keep it moving.
So I think some people are more conscious of this than others, and trying to come to one of these things. So I'm in my mid-30s. So a lot of my friends are right around this age as well. So for just speaking to maybe people who haven't been conscious of this type of programming or thought process growing up, anything that's outside of your norm or your routine is very uncomfortable. And we already kind of spoke about discomfort. You've spoken about courage before. How do you sort of gain the courage? Because the fear comes from your body just craves homeostasis, right? The norm is like your body feels comfortable with that. So you will do bizarre things to sort
of
maintain
that. Even if it's negative, even if it's negativity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you're at least used to that. Be like, this is, it's negative, but it's comfortable. Like, you know how to regulate in that way, right? So how do you facilitate the courage to get people to, like, try to break that homeostasis, which from an evolutionary standpoint is like very uncomfortable. It's like you want what's comfortable and familiar.
it takes time. It really does take time. And it takes some knowledge too, and understanding that our mind plays tricks on us. You know, one piece of evidence to that is panic attacks. That panic attack is a mind trick. There's something that's happening right in front of you right now that is reminding you of something that happened a long time ago. And you're having that fear right now of something close to happening a long time ago. You're probably sitting in class, you're eating a Pop-Tart, and you're flipping your shit. And it's a trick. And so when you understand that the mind is so powerful that it will trick you, then you have to go, wait a second. Maybe those things I was taught wasn't actually true. And I think that what you have to do is you have to not be so personal about it. The things that were taught to us, the programming that we were given, was given to us by people that actually love us and care about us. But they could still be wrong. They could be unhealthy. They could be dysfunctional. They can be abusive. Don't take it personally. Give yourself the pause to go, wait a second, I have a right and I actually have a responsibility to change my mind when I get evidence to the contrary of a thought that has been laid within me. Give yourself the space to take in new information. That is the beauty of being an adult. That is, I think, the responsibility of being a knowledgeable, confident, smart adult, is that when you get evidence, when you get new evidence, you need to make new decisions. And when you decide to do something that goes against your programming, it doesn't mean you love the people that program you any less. You don't love them any less. They made decisions and they programmed you with the information they had at the time. Case in point, go to college. You got to get a four-year degree. We now know since 2008, having a four-year degree doesn't guarantee a damn thing. We now know having a job in corporate America doesn't guarantee you any kind of security. Owning a house at a certain age doesn't guarantee you any kind of wealth. We now know this. And so the younger generations are taking this all in and they're doing things differently. They're moving differently. They're taking PTO. The older generations, where you could raise a family of four on $30,000 and you have a gold watch after being in a job for 30 years, that's what they grew up in. We now know there's no guarantee of that. So you have to move differently. It's not an attack on you. It doesn't mean that you're stupid. It doesn't mean that you've done anything wrong. It's just you've taken the evidence of the times of today and you move differently because of that evidence. And you owe it to yourself to do that.
Yeah, that's great advice. I don't want to get too far off of this line of thinking, but you mentioned panic attacks, and it is such a common thing. So do you have any like tools or tricks for people that they can use like in the moment? Like how can they, I'm assuming, I don't know, feel free to correct me and feel free to give as much context on panic attacks as you want. You're either living too far in the past, like the mind is bringing you back to something in the past, or it's projecting fears into the future, but you're just not in the present moment. So any tools or tricks that people can utilize to get them back to a better state when they're having a panic attack, I think that'd be really valuable.
Absolutely. I like to lean on the five senses. That will bring you to the present moment. Lean on the five senses. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's a great grounding technique. And so what you can do is, and you can do this quietly, you can do this anywhere. You can do this behind the wheel of a car. You can do this in a classroom. You can do this at work or on a plane. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and consider the five senses. 5. Look at 5 things within a room wherever you are right now. And let's say you're behind the wheel of a car and you could see a traffic light, stop sign, your purse in the seat next to you, your drink that's in the console. Maybe you see a car beside you. 4, touch 4 things. If you're back in the car, touch the steering wheel, touch your horn, touch the seat, touch your dog if it's beside you. If you're in a classroom, touch your desk, touch a pencil, touch your backpack, touch paper on your desk. 3 things that you can hear in your present moment. Cars honking, dogs barking, someone chewing on their pencil, chalk on a chalkboard. 2, smell. What can you smell right now? And you can smell whatever you're drinking. If you've got a pen or a marker in your hand, sniff that. Your hand, if you've got lotion or cologne on it, what is right in front of you? Taste. Take a drink of water. Take a snack. Chew on your pencil if you need to. But the point is, like you made a good point, a panic attack, typically what it is, there's something from the past. There's something in the present that's reminding you of the past and you're projecting into the future like, oh, shit, I hope this doesn't happen again.
Okay. Yep. All right. I appreciate the explanation.
Combination of things that are happening like within a split second, all of these things are happening all at the same time. So what you're trying to do is bring yourself back to the present moment and you need to remind yourself, I'm safe right now. Mm-hmm. Nothing is harming me right now. Slow, deep breaths. I'm sitting in my classroom right now. I'm at work. I can hear the ticking of the clock on the wall. Lunchtime is soon. I'm going to take a bite of my sandwich. These are all things to bring you back to the present moment, to remind yourself that you're not in that scary moment that happened in the past. And you're not in this future moment that hasn't even happened yet. You're right here, right now. Stay present. Stick with the five senses. Sometimes let's say you're outside, go ground yourself. Lean up against a tree. Lean up against a wall. Take your shoes off. Put your feet in the dirt. Literally ground yourself to remind yourself of your current safety, not some past moment that is gone.
I appreciate you explaining all that. And I think the 5-4-3-2-1 protocol, I think that'd be really helpful and like a very easy thing to have in your toolkit in the case that you're having a panic attack. So I appreciate you explaining that. And then on that line of thinking, do you teach mindfulness or any sort of breath work? Because so much of what you just spoke about was just getting back to the present moment. So is that one of the tools that you ever implement with clients?
I do. I will have moments with clients where they are running throughout their day. And then they like our therapy session has been slid in between meetings and they'll come in hot. They will come in hot to this therapy session and I'll see it. I mean, it's obvious. You can see it when someone's really stressed out or just
amplified. And you can feel it too, right?
You can feel it. And yeah. I have to protect myself to make sure that I don't take on other people's energy. Yep. And so I'll call out the moment and I'll just say, hold on. And I'll literally put my hands up. Hold on. Let's just breathe right now. Just. And push it out and hear yourself pushing out the breath. Don't count it. It's not about intervals. It's just about breathing in. Get the cheeks fat, because also what you're trying to shift your way of thinking. And if let's say it's one of those moments, I was just with a client who works at Amazon and he is going hardcore all the time. And I'll have to say to him, nope, you're here now. You're not in a meeting. You're here now. This is your healing moment. Take it. You don't have to rush yourself here, and I'm not going to rush you. And you need to function differently in this moment. And we have to understand that as we're navigating meetings and picking your kids up from school and going out to dinner with friends, be in that moment. Take a few seconds to breathe. It doesn't have to be some full-on transcendental meditation moment that you take on the bus. It doesn't have to be that at all. Just a few deep breaths and remind yourself, I'm at the restaurant. I'm going to play with my kid. I'm riding a bike right now. Bring yourself to that moment so you can fully enjoy it. And you're not spread across a bunch of different responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think anything using your senses it's a very powerful tool to bring you back to the present moment, whether it's the breath, whether it's physically touching something. It's kind of going back to exactly what you talked about with panic attacks. I was laughing when you said, I need to protect myself. Are you naturally like really empathetic? Because I read a book about a year ago, actually. I think it was called Whose Feelings Are These? Or Are These Feelings Mine? Something like that. And it was all about like how to navigate the world as an empath, which I'm not necessarily, but it was still a very interesting book where it's like, empaths will take on the energy and the emotions of people around them. And this book is trying to help people identify, be like, are these even my feelings? Or are these just the energies and emotions of the people I've been surrounded with all day?
You know, that empath, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's so much that can be said about that. But you know what? Being an empath is just, I got a whole lot of fucking trauma. That's what it means. That means that early on, I had to pay attention to whoever was around me and look at their behavior and their tone of voice and how they were interacting in order to protect myself. And instead of leaving that in the past, because I haven't completely healed it, I've now taken that into my present. I've reframed it as empath. But yeah, it is taking on other people's emotions, but it's meant to protect yourself from that, from their whims, from their emotional whims. And so, yeah, it's important for you to separate what belongs to them and what belongs to me. And it takes a beat to do that. But when you're an empath, you typically will take on other people's crap. And it bleeds into codependency too. Well, you will take other people's crap and you will feel that I have to be responsible for it. I got to show you how much I love you. I've got a people pleasing is involved in that too. It's so layered, but I have to shield myself from other people's crap, but I have always been that person where people will spill their guts to me. And I'm like, hey, let's make a career out of it. You know, I went from, you know, being a reality TV show producer and now I'm a therapist, and it all comes together in the same way. Nurses, doctors, attorneys, journalists, It's all connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. And it's like a very nice segue to kind of discuss your sort of career path at this point. I'd love if you could share a little bit about what got you to this point. But my main question around that was like, do you feel like you came to being a therapist at the right time in your life? Or is it something you wish you'd gotten into it earlier?
100%. It wasn't something that I ever thought about. And when I really needed a therapist in my childhood, I didn't even know that it was a thing. I had no clue. I started therapy in my early 30s. And I grew up in Texas where no one talks about anything negative. You don't talk about what's happening in your home. You don't. Everything's smiley and great and wonderful. And I was at a work meeting. It was the first day of a job. I was at a work lunch with brand new coworkers, and one of my coworkers who is now my best friend, but we were having lunch and she said something so casually, and she was like, oh, my therapist, John Elliott. And I was like, what? She's clearly sane. And she goes to therapy and she's just saying it out loud. Cause I was taught that, you know, crazy people do therapy. You go to church. Or only really fucked up people go to therapy. That's what I was taught. And here was this person that was clearly sane and calm and confident. And so I had to break down what I had been told, what I was programmed to think. I broke it down in that moment with her. And so I started going to therapy. And still didn't think about becoming a therapist, but I was on the road working on two different shows where it was that both environments were really, really, one was extremely toxic and the other one was really dysfunctional. And I wanted to intervene. I wanted to have conversations. I wanted to say, why are you having sex with that person? Why are you taking all these shots? Why are you blowing that horrible situation off and acting like it's no big deal? I wanted to intervene, but that wasn't my role. And I just had this moment where it's like, I need to change my role then. I need to change my role. I want to be able to help people feel better instead of being the person that throws a camera on them when they're in their worst moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you just give a little context for anyone who isn't familiar with your background? Can you explain like what kind of shows you were working on just so they have a little more backstory to those statements?
Sure. For several years, I worked in television entertainment. I was a producer and director on reality TV shows, and I worked on a variety of shows, you know, from Bad Girls Club to Last Comic Standing to MTV's The Real World and a bunch of other shows. And the environments were typically very volatile, which is, that's entertainment. You know, and typically the cast are very young in their early 20s. And it's, you know, people on reality TV shows are people who have been cast because they don't have filters. They snap. They speak their mind without thinking things through. And that's why cameras are on them. That's entertainment. And it was fun for a really long time until it wasn't. And I had to do something else. I did. And I'd done that work for a very long time. I even hosted a few shows. I did stand-up comedy myself. I was on stage for several years telling jokes. And then I just matured. I think that's what it was. I evolved. I matured. A big part of it was being a part of my own therapy and then realizing that I really do want my time, you know, call it an existential crisis. You know, I want my time on this earth to mean something that helps people feel better about themselves. And so I had to just switch things up.
I imagine this feels much more in line with those desires than with what you're doing now.
I'm seriously cleansing some karma now. Cleansing my TV karma.
Yeah, you feel like you owe from a few years. I feel like, so you mentioned before that kind of where you grew up and at the time that you grew up, mental health was not something that was discussed, or if it was, it was in this very negative frame. And I grew up not too different from that. And I'm sure a lot of people still have sort of had that perspective where it's like, if you're going to therapy, it's like, it's because you're crazy, air quotes, right? I do feel like nationally, the stigma around mental health is improving. It's getting better. And it's being discussed more on TV and stuff like that. But you have so much experience with TV, and you discussed this in another podcast to some extent. Can you talk about how mental health is portrayed on TV in particular contexts? Because if it feels like there can almost be this, almost like this fetishization of trauma to a certain extent, and this like it can be almost performative, it seems like. Yeah, so I think you have a bit more expertise in that area, but anything you can discuss on the concept of how mental health is portrayed on TV, I think would be interesting to explore.
It's funny, the very first show that I ever produced was a show that had two therapists on it. And it was a show about couples who were having relationship issues, and the two therapists were giving them interventions in order to improve their relationship. Fast forward to the second to the last show. Well, actually, fast forward to the show that I was on, where I thought, this sucks. This is horrible. And the talent on that show was actually doing her therapy on camera. Now, again, I had never thought about being a therapist, but I'm there and I'm directing these scenes. And she'd been doing, I was on the fourth season of the show. She'd been doing therapy on the show since maybe for a couple of years up to that point. And my whole thought was, this is so unethical. And that is not a word that you use in reality TV. People want you to be unethical. But I'm like, this feels so exploitive because she's dancing. She and her therapist are both dancing around things that are really obvious, really obvious. And it's like, oh, she's exploiting herself. Oh, because she wants another season. And so, you know, I don't know that exploitive word. I don't know. I mean, you could say blanket wise, yes, TV is exploitive to reality TV show cast, but I don't believe that TV, the industry, needs to be responsible for adults that have decided this is what I want to do and they're getting paid to do it. Personal responsibility comes into play here. It just does, because no one's forcing anybody to do this. They're all getting paid. They have to apply to do it. And it takes months to get cast on a show before the cameras ever show up. So you need to be responsible for yourself when you're deciding to do this. And we are not in the beginning of this where you didn't know exactly how the editing was going to go down. You know.
Yeah, she's a few years into this.
Yeah, we're decades into this shit now. You know what can come from this, so own it. But I think that this is also where this is a societal issue where we're now, you know, we're this social media world where everybody is seeking external validation. everybody is looking for ways that people can applaud them, love them, see them, hear them. So even if you're not on a reality TV show and you snub your nose at it, you're still probably on Instagram or Facebook and you're looking to see how many likes you've got. It's the same thing. You are the top dog on your own reality show when it's your social media pages. So exploiting, yes, but that is the fabric of our society, which is we're always looking for people that, you know, we can make money on. That's just the way capitalism is what is in charge these days. And it sucks, but it's the truth. And I think the sooner you realize what is manipulating you, the better off you're going to be. And take personal accountability for what you allow yourself to get sucked into or not. You know, I saw this great video and it was Denzel Washington. And he was Denzel, what is he, in his 60s at this point? And he was talking about social media and he was talking about the addiction to phones. And he says, you don't think you're addicted? Don't touch it for a week. He's like, just the thought of it scares you. You're addicted.
So given all that, how do you suggest people navigate with the prevalence of social media? And that I think social media is just a way to describe the current state of the internet. It's not like the separate side of the internet. It's like it's the most prevalent state of the internet. So how do you suggest people, while trying to improve or maintain their mental health, navigate social media, which is not necessarily the most conducive thing for that?
You know, I think that, you know, it goes back to being uncomfortable. You know, when we're uncomfortable, we got to look into that and lean into it. You know, you know, for several years, people were doing what's your New Year's resolution? And then now it's recently changed into what is your word of the year? My word of the year this year was uncomfortable. I want to be uncomfortable. I want to know what's on the other side of discomfort. I want to be curious about it. I want to be curious about what drives me crazy, what makes me happy, what calms me down. And if something drives me crazy, why? And I think these challenges, we've got to challenge ourselves. You know, we're in this space now where nobody wants to be uncomfortable. Everybody wants everything to be absolutely as easy as possible. And there's a sacrifice that's made in that. There's a huge sacrifice. And to really pull it all the way out, let's look at education. You know, you've got kids that aren't being educated anymore. They're doing Scantrons. You know, they're just you're not learning a damn thing. You're just learning how to take a test. You're not learning the material. And so having everything so easy to you, you've got to peel back the curtain and go, why? Why? And I say, challenge yourself. If there's anything that makes you scared just by hearing about it, you got to look into it. You've been triggered in some way. Lean into it. I'm doing this thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of Vipassana. It's a type of meditation retreat, and it's the 10-day silent meditation retreat. I'm doing it for the second time this spring. And anytime I've brought it up to people, they immediately recoil.
Oh, no, oh, I'm like, God. I've totally been into that.
I can't imagine not talking to anybody. I can't imagine not looking at my phone. I can't imagine. Maybe you should. Mm-hmm. See why. What's in charge of you? What's in control of you? Get curious about it. Don't be judgmental. Get curious about it. Lean into all those uncomfortable things and see what's on the other side.
What were your takeaways from the first one that you had done?
My takeaways were really understanding what are the things that trigger certain behaviors in myself. Realizing when my distractions, the typical things that I use to distract myself, when those are taken away, where mm-hmm. does my mind go?
Yeah.
And I realized, like, I'm a strong person. I've been through a lot of shit. I help a lot of people, but I realized I'm not as strong as I thought. Crap.
Is it like an uncomfortable thought and you're immediately going to one of those distractions?
But and that's the thing, in that, and you have access to nothing. You're not even supposed to make eye contact with people. There's no talking. There's no phone. There's no TV. It's just you. And when I first heard about it, it scared me shitless. But then I went into, ooh, like I like challenging and I like being scared because I realize that I'm always better on the other end of uncovering what has scared the crap out of me. I'm always better for it. And I've learned that. One of my friends did it before I did. And she called me as soon as it was over. She called me and I said, "What was it like? Tell me everything." She's like, "I cried for 4 days straight." And I said, "Count me in, sign me up." Because I've realized, and this is a hard thing to realize, but this is the beauty of the therapy that I do with my clients, is gaining confidence from the hard crap that you've survived. Not running from it, not shying away from it, not burying it and suppressing it, looking at it and go, "Look what I got through." Not being embarrassed, not being self-conscious. "Look what I got through." There's something really beautiful about that. And it becomes this thing that becomes really like addictive. Like, I'm going to do these really uncomfortable things. That's why I did stand up. I didn't do stand up because I wanted to be a comedian. I wanted to be on a TV show. I did it because I was always typically very shy and didn't share my opinions. And shit, people are going to look at me. They're going to have to listen to me. I've got a microphone. And I was so scared, so very scared. And I did it anyway. And so that's kind of what I do. I lean into the things that scare me so they stop scaring me.
Take the power away from that fear. Did you have a meditation practice before doing that retreat? No, just dove right in.
I just dove right into it. I tried to meditate off and on, but I realized that with me, and this was a hard thing to realize, sitting quietly was hard to do because I was raised in being productive. You got to be productive. You need to be doing something, always be doing something. It's very much a woman thing and it's very much a Black woman thing. You got to do something. You've got to be doing something. And just sitting somewhere and not doing something, that's what it looked like on the outside. But it's repair work. It's healing. It's taking time for yourself. And those are really rare moments. They're necessary, but they're really, really rare. And I never did any kind of consistent meditation. I still don't, to be perfectly honest with you. I know that I should. I know that it's good for me. I try here and there. I'll do 30 seconds here, 5 minutes there. I know it's healthy and I know it's necessary. So that's why I dive into it in these ways. But I didn't have any kind of meditation practice before. And they actually prefer that you don't. They prefer that you aren't this, you know, but a lot of people in those rooms are super, super, I call them super meditators. And I remember in a moment where, like, I'm a wiggly person. I've got ADHD. It is what it is. And as everybody's sitting really quietly and they're meditating, I'm like this, you know, everybody's got their eyes closed. I'm doing this. I'm checking everybody out and everybody's just statues. And I'm like,
I bet if you'd caught the other person in the room at the right time, you could have caught it. Because, like, I'm sure other people are doing that.
We could have fallen in love. Who knows?
Right, exactly. Yeah, you would have found each other.
Yeah, they give you moments to talk to the instructors and during your time there. And they're the only people you can talk to and only for about 5 minutes. And so I was talking to one of the teachers and I said, "I can't stop wiggling. I'm doing this whole thing wrong." And she's like, "So what? You're a meditator that wiggles." And I go, and I keep open my eyes and I keep looking around. She goes, "So what? You look around. Who cares?" And it was so simple, but she gave me the permission to be me. And it was so simple, but I'd never thought about it that way. I was just so programmed, like everything you do needs to look a certain way. And when I realized it doesn't have to look any way, it needs to look the way that works best for me.
Yeah, it's such a powerful like way to shift your mindset or the frame that you're looking at it through. Mm-hmm. And I guess enough that, so why are you going back to do it a second time?
I love torture. For very personal reasons. I have lived on the West Coast for years. Moved to Houston, which is where I grew up. I've been here for a year. It has been a shit show. Being back home for a variety of reasons. And it's like, I feel like I need to ground myself. And I feel like I need to check out of my routine. I need to reset myself. So I'm doing it as a reset, as a as a way of detoxifying from like a digital detoxification process. And they're always in gorgeous places. They're always in really beautiful, scenic, natural settings. So I like challenging myself. I like healing, and I like discovering different parts of myself. I like having aha moments about me. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's really remarkable how challenging it is to just sit and, like you said, do nothing for extended periods of time. Like, people will be shocked if you've never done it, how long 20 minutes can be, no less 10 days.
Yep. Yeah.
That's pretty incredible. So I wanted to kind of move on to talking about your book, Mourning the Living. Can you give a little bit of backstory to the title? And for anyone who, I mean, we're going to link to it in the show notes, but it's mourning as in the passing of someone, not like a what comes after the nighttime. So can you share a little bit about that book? And then we're going to dive into some of the subjects in there as well.
Sure. The full title is Mourning the Living, When the Loved One You've Lost is Still Here. And it is about grieving people that, you know, were really important parts of our lives. And they're next door, down the street, across town, across the country, and they're still alive. But we're distant for whatever reason. And the distance may not even fully be we don't speak. It could be we see each other every week. You could be my husband or wife in the bed next to me, but there are certain things that we don't talk. We're not intimate anymore. We don't know each other anymore. I am grieving what I thought our dynamic should be. I'm grieving what it used to be. And so each chapter is a different relationship dynamic. So mothers, fathers, children, siblings, partners, friends, ourselves. And the book starts with, why is it so hard for us to create boundaries? Why is it so hard for us to have functional relationships with people? So it talks about trauma bonding. It talks about the lack of self-care, talks about dysfunctional family systems as a whole. And, you know, what gets poured into us by people, and are they healthy people? Or are they dysfunctional people? And what gets poured into us, who programs us, is how we see ourselves and see the world. Sometimes it's great and healthy and positive, and sometimes it's crap that needs to be unlearned. And that crap permeates all of our relationships, whether we want to own it or not. And so it is about, how do you either create boundaries and maintain them with toxic, dysfunctional people, or do you decide to cut off the relationship altogether? And then how do you deal with the emotions that are involved in that?
Yeah, so we're going to get into the idea of cutting off relationships entirely, which I'm sure is going to be a little bit dependent on each person and the relationship. But I think if you could share a little bit more about what trauma bonding is, I think that would be a nice backstory to kind of frame the rest of these sort of relationship conversations.
Trauma bonding is, there's a fine line. Trauma bonding is sometimes when you meet someone and there's that immediate spark, if it's a romantic relationship, that immediate, oh my gosh. Sometimes it's amazing and it's love and it's fantastic, but a lot of times it's the pain in me sees the pain in you. And we're familiar. We've got this familiar, unhealed energy that we're going to lock into each other. Trauma bonding. And a lot of people are trauma bonded. And I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of relationships don't work, because somebody grows out of their trauma. Somebody heals their trauma, and who they now are as a healed person isn't compatible with this person that hasn't done a damn thing to heal themselves.
It feels like they're no longer connected in the same way that they originally were.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that happens a lot with people who go into therapy, that a lot of it doesn't get talked about very often. A lot of times when people go into therapy, they end up ending whatever relationship they were in when they started it, because their self-esteem gets raised. They get healed, and whatever they were attracted to is no longer attractive. Whatever they thought was totally okay and fine treatment, they realize I'm worth more than that. Because there was typically a trauma bond. That's what brought you guys together, whether you realize it or not.
Gotcha. That's a good explanation. And yeah, I don't think that does get talked about a ton. This is kind of the first explicitly I've heard of it. I'm sure you hear of it in more subtle ways, but yeah.
Here's a subtle way. This is the no one has used the, the phrase trauma bond to describe it, but this is what it is. We have forever heard girls marry their daddies.
Mm-hmm.
That's trauma bond. A girl who marries a man, a woman who marries a man that's just like her father, it's a trauma bond, because whatever is unfinished business between her and her father, she seeks out a partner that's similar, and she will work out or not work out, but still be in relationship with that similar dysfunctional energy. Boys and men do it with women as well. Whatever you did not heal with your mother in that mother-child dynamic, you will find a partner that's just like your mom.
The mind is wild, isn't it? Isn't it crazy?
Because it's familiar. The mind, it's just fascinating. It's fascinating. But you will keep, and just think about the people that you know that date the same people over and over. I would say this about my sister. The reason I wrote Mourning the Living is because of my older sister, who I love dearly, but she's an addict. And whenever we were growing up, she's an addict. She became an addict in her 40s. Like, who becomes an addict in their 40s? But this was just years of trauma that was never healed. And because as I was healing, I had to distance myself from her in order to protect myself. And that was a very hard thing to do. I felt a lot of anger. I felt a lot of guilt. But I needed to do what I needed to do in order to survive that dynamic. And that the biggest, hardest part of that was just saying, no, we can't be around each other. We just can't. So, you know, that whole, you know, what we don't heal, we repeat. It's true. If you don't heal what's going on with you, you're going to repeat it over and over again. And a lot of people don't realize it. They don't want to realize it. But, you know, I talk to parents all the time that are parenting their children in such a way, and they hate it. What they're doing to their own children was done to them, and they hated it, and they do it anyway.
Yeah, I think life has this funny way of trying to keep teaching you lessons until you finally learn them.
And that's what I say about my sister. With my sister, it's like, I don't want to know, like, we don't communicate now. But when we did, I would never ask her about who she was dating. I would always just say, same asshole, different name. Because it was always the same dynamic. It was always some ridiculous situation. It was a different person, but it was the same ridiculous situation because she hadn't healed. And that's a great way to realize, you know, do you have something that needs to be healed? Do you have the same thing that keeps happening? You date the same type of person. You end up in the same situations at jobs. It's different jobs, but it's the same situation. Those cycles, you got to lean into those cycles and you got to heal something. And typically it's based in who raised us, what was happening at home when we were little kids.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how so much of it just gets traced back to your childhood and your upbringing in that environment when everyone's like, oh, I have all these very unique situations and all these things happened to me growing up. And it's like probably a lot of just what happened when you were a kid, which is really bizarre. One of the things I wanted to ask you regarding your sister is like, can you kind of look back on your life? Because you two took different trajectories in your life, but similar upbringing. Were there like inflection points that you can identify where it was like, this is where I started going down this route and was able to heal myself and she unfortunately could not?
Yes. I realize as I've pinpointed my, as I have reflected on my healing journey, I realize there are several things that we did differently. And many of those things I didn't realize in the moment. I just can look back and go, oh. One of the things was I realized what my strengths were as I was growing up. I was gregarious and I never wanted to be at home. So I joined every club, so I wouldn't be at home. Shit, sorry. So I joined every club you could imagine so I wouldn't be at home, which was where the toxic stuff was going down. I also would spend time hanging out in other friends' homes. friends' homes where, you know, they had both parents in the home, parents both had jobs, the lights were always on. I spent time in those environments. My sister did not do that. My sister wasn't involved in clubs. She didn't do that. She, anytime somebody would say, hey, Melody, do you want to come spend the weekend over here? Aunt, uncle, friend, whatever. My answer was always yes. Always yes. My sister didn't do that. I got lucky in a lot of ways too. A lot of this wasn't intentional decision-making on my part. I got really lucky. My first boyfriend was like the best first boyfriend a girl could ask for. My sister didn't have that. In a lot of ways, he set the tone for every relationship I've ever had to this point, even. He was so good. He was so amazing. He was kind. He was loving. He was honest and he was fantastic. That made a big impression on me that this is what I started with. The bar is high. I went into therapy, and that was a huge thing too. But me going to the therapy, that was decades later. I started therapy in my 30s, but I was open. I was open to being challenged and to doing things that were unfamiliar to me or doing things that didn't make sense to me or even things that were told to me, don't do that. Fuck it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try it.
Yeah. It sounds like those experiences, like you were exposed to different worldviews and different environments that showed you that like, this is not what life is.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you said that, Parker. That's exactly what it was. I had counter experiences that I thought, okay, the way I live in this house looks one way. And then I would go into other environments and go, okay, that's a different way. And that's another way. And that's a totally different way. So what I'm doing, how I'm living is not the only way. And she didn't get that. She didn't, you know, she didn't take that rope of, you know, give it a shot. Let me rescue you. She didn't take that. And I clamored for that thing. And having different experience helped me know that you can live in different ways. And she's still living in the exact same way that we grew up in, which is dysfunctional, which is chaotic. And we're like night and day, but grew up in the exact same house with the same parents.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate because like at that age, whatever age as a kid, you're a kid. You're not thinking like what are the consequences of this going to be 40 years from now? Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me, somebody was talking about sending a rocket to the moon and the amount of micro adjustments that have to be made along every step. And it's like mm-hmm. one of those micro adjustments early on that is not correct. You're missing the moon by so far, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just unfortunate because so much of it happens at an age where it's like, it's kind of a luck of the draw. Like, did you have a friend that exposed you to this good alternative environment or not? And it's like, that can totally bifurcate the trajectory mm-hmm. of your life.
Mm-hmm. That can't be underestimated when it comes to how I grew up. And I was very much intimidated by the people that I grew up with. Because I grew up in poverty. We grew up on public assistance. And yet, you know, one of my childhood best friends, her uncle was the governor of our state. Another childhood best friend, her grandfather was the mayor of our town, you know, where we had our lights were getting cut off all the time. Like these are kids that had BMWs and Rolex watches at 16. And I pushed past being uncomfortable because I wanted the exposure. I wanted the experience. And that's where luck came in. You know, I didn't plan any of that. But I just took chances. I took chances. And part of what I did too was, even though I feel very different about myself, of course, at this age that I did whenever I was a teenager and a little kid, and this goes back to our earlier conversation, which is how do you get to that place where you feel comfortable being vulnerable. I leaned into other people's thoughts of me before I even created, you know, my vision of myself. And I respect this person. I think this person's amazing. If they think I'm amazing, I must be amazing. I did that. I got lucky because it turns out those people were amazing. Thank God. That goes wrong in a lot of ways. You know, that can go wrong in so many ways. And that's where luck came in. When I left Houston and I moved to Los Angeles, the very first show I worked on, one of the senior producers on that show created a show that was hugely popular when I was a little kid. And this man took me under his wing and he took me to all these amazing events. I met Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. And I remember there was something he used to say. We worked at Warner Brothers and he used to say, and this is a man who's one of the kindest people in Hollywood. He's just a sweetheart. And he used to say, I'm going to be working for you someday. He's like, we're all going to be working for you someday. I never forgot that. This person that I have so much respect for and everybody loves and adores and has so much respect for, he's saying that about me? Huh. That must mean something. And then I eventually developed that within myself, but it was those little moments that I hung on to along the way.
So before we kind of get off that thread, can you speak to, I think people really undervalue the power of words and the power that words can have on people. So can you speak to any advice of like always, maybe not always, but trying to very consciously put out positive energy and positive messaging to the world and the people that you're interacting with? Because like the example that you just gave is this person lifting you up, right? And we never know the influence that our words are going to have on somebody. Is that something you try to focus on with clients? Because it can end up being like when you start focusing outward, you're a little bit less like self-obsessed and sort of the stuff that you could be like ruminating over. So is kind of focusing positive energy and words outward on other people, is that a tool that you ever use with any of your clients?
Absolutely. I was with a client the other day that male in his 40s, married with children, works at a huge company and, you know, struggling to make his relationships work. And we were talking about Christmas and how did his Christmas go down? And he was telling me about different interactions. And I stopped him along the way as he was telling the story. And I'm like, that was amazing. That's not something you felt comfortable doing before. And look at you, you did it. And you didn't even think about it. And you just did it. And I'm like, you totally dodged that. That could have been a huge fight. And you just moved right on past that. Good for you. And at the end of this exchange, he said, thank you for that. And I go, what? He goes, you made me realize things that I was doing and I didn't even realize I was doing. And I wasn't giving myself credit for that. And so much of what I do is I do for people what I want them to do for themselves. And when I start therapy with people, one of the things that I always say is, I'm going to be your biggest cheerleader until you knock me off the pyramid. I want you to be your biggest cheerleader, but I'm going to hold that. I'm going to hold that role until you get there. And it's necessary. And, you know, positive self-talk is a big thing. Like, you have to rewire your brain. You have to rewire how you're speaking to yourself. You have to rewire how you think of yourself, and you do it in small steps where, you know, let's say you don't do something that you told somebody you were going to do. You told your kid you were going to bring cupcakes to the party and you forgot to bring cupcakes. Instead of beating yourself up and go, you know what? That really sucks that I didn't bring cupcakes, you know, but I brought cupcakes like a million times before and I'm going to set an alarm. I'll bring them again next time. They're fine. There were enough cupcakes. It's fine. They all survived not having cupcakes. So just those little moments that you can take with yourself where you're just bolstering yourself up and you're letting yourself, you know, cutting yourself slack whenever you can. You need to do those things for yourself. And you need to pat yourself on the back too for obviously the good big stuff, but the little stuff too. Like my mom texted me and she, you know, she talked trash about how I was parenting my kid and I didn't reply. I didn't take the bait. Look at me. That's self-care. You know, you're exercising a personal boundary where you're not going to take the bait of somebody that wants to treat you like crap.
All right. You've bitten down on that one enough times already.
You know what this is going to look like. So now you need to challenge yourself by doing something different. And you may get really nervous about it. You're going to be anxious about it. You may feel a little guilty about it. That's fine. It's going to be easier the next time you do it. it's going to be easier the next time you do it. But we have so much power to lift people up. We really do. And our words are so powerful. And I don't think people really give enough respect for the power of our words to ourselves and to other people. And there's this one phrase that I really, 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 really hate that a lot of people do because it sounds funny and it's cute and it's funny. FML, fuck my life. I hate it when people say that. Fuck my life. Okay, fine. Like, you don't realize what you're putting out there into the universe with that. You're perpetuating something so that you can point the finger and go, see, told you, see, see. Well, if you, whatever you put your energy into, that's what's going to grow. And if you all, if you always put your energy into bad things are going to happen to you, guess what? They're going to happen to you because that's what your brain is expecting. You may be saying it just to tell a story and be cheeky on social media, but it's powerful. So be careful what you say and what you speak to yourself. And be very careful what you speak to other people because you really can lift them up or tear them down. And I know that when it comes to my sister, I had a lot of people say some amazing things to me. And I know some horrible things were said to her. And, you know, you were saying very early on, it's like, you know, we can lean into the negatives, but we don't have to. But we have to be really, really intentional about overriding those messages that don't serve us. You have to be intentional about it. That's why affirmations are so fantastic. And it feels awkward at first. Whenever you do anything at first, it feels really awkward. But just know it's not always going to feel awkward.
Yeah, I think everyone is much more powerful than they give themselves credit for. And the words they speak and the thoughts that they hold in their mind, as you were kind of alluding to. But yeah, so I'm glad you could elaborate so eloquently on kind of the power of lifting people up. And how that can influence yourself as well. I want to go back to kind of talking about courage and the courage to kind of make a really tough decision of to no longer speak to your sister. Can you kind of explain the thought process and like what got you to that point where you're like, this is where I need this hard line boundary for that particular relationship?
I don't have children. My sister has three. And my sister started treating her children the way that we were treated. The same environments, the same wording, the same chaotic behavior and decision making. And that's where I had to draw the line because you're doing to them what you know damaged us. And I can't stand for it. And so I did what I could to intervene. I did a lot of financial help for the kids. And then her youngest I took and raised for years. And you know, there was something that a professor said to me when I was in graduate school that stuck with me. She said, just because you know why somebody is fucking up doesn't give them the excuse to fuck up. I know her trauma. I know her pain. I know all the horrible things that were done to her. Hey, they were done to me too, but I'm not perpetuating that. I know how hard it is to heal. I know how hard it is to be honest. I know how hard it is to look in the face of some horrible shit. I know, but I also know it can be done because I've done it. And so it was hard, but I knew that as I started writing the book, I'd realized that, yeah, I did the same thing with our mother. I did it with our father. I can cut people off. But I give you a chance. I have a conversation first. And I think that's a really key part of this. It doesn't do any good if you cut someone off and they don't know why. And when you're dealing with a narcissistic person that can easily go from bully to victim, they will create their own narrative. And so for your own conscience, speak your truth. Say what's on your mind. Say what you expect from them. Say what you won't take from them. Say it. And the beautiful part of that is it gives people the line that they cannot cross. And if they cross it, that's all you need to go. Done. But you have to have self-worth. You have to trust yourself too. And I think a part of trusting yourself is just really being honest and present and going, how do I feel right now? when I interact with this person, do I feel depleted? Do I feel excited? Do I feel happy? Do I feel abused? Do I feel exhausted? Like, you got to really pay attention to how you feel as you're in certain environments interacting with certain people, and let your feelings be your guide. Do you feel that you're rehearsing comebacks before you hang out with a certain person? Do you feel that you're shortening the amount of time? You're lying about where you need to be to cut off that lunch meeting or that holiday stop. Listen to yourself. Trust yourself. If you feel that you're not 100% able to be authentic and honest in an interaction with somebody, you're afraid of how they're going to respond, you're afraid what they're going to say and what they're going to think, the dynamic is off. Power is off. You're not good. And you don't have to function in that. And you know, in a lot of ways, we've been taught that, you know, old people, they deserve all the respect.
I love that. I think that'll be very helpful advice for a lot of people listening. I appreciate you sharing that about your relationship with your sister too. On the idea of addiction, I know there's this, it's commonly said that it runs in the family. And one of the questions I had about that is whether or not it's like, is this purely a genetically driven thing, or is this more environmental? Because those can both lead to the statement of it runs in the family. But I think there's a big difference between this being like a biological genetic thing versus this is an environmental factor just because we grew up there.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I had this conversation just yesterday with two of my girlfriends that are therapists. I believe that addiction is it's a symptom of generational trauma. I believe addiction is a symptom of generational trauma. I believe that however you're taught to tie your shoes and make a sandwich is how you're also taught how to cope. You know, and if you see the people around you coping with alcohol or drugs, then that's what you're going to do. So I don't believe necessarily that addiction is a disease. I think that disease wording came from people who wanted to have their rehab covered by insurance. So let's slap disease on it, because you know what? You don't have to drink. It's something that you're choosing to do, but there are a lot of people that get lung cancer out of nowhere. So it's controversial, but it's just the way that I think. I think that there are things that come through our DNA, hair color, athleticism, how you sing, but how we cope does as well. And if you see people coping with certain things in certain ways, whether it's picking up vodka or punching a hole through a wall or punching a person, that's what you're going to do.
Have you read anything by Gabor Mate?
He is my guru. I love that man. I love him. I'm at the end of The Myth of Normal right now.
Okay. Based on what you're talking about, I'm like, you seem familiar with his work. I'm in the middle of reading that book right now, and it's...
Everybody highly, on the planet needs to read that book.
Highly enjoyable right now. We'll definitely link to that in the show notes. I do have a few more questions for you. I wanted to ask if writing the book, and you've written Mourning the Living, you have another book coming out, and I think it's going to be out by the time this comes out. This is going to be out the end of March 2024. Is writing a form of therapy for you? It's just like super long form journaling almost.
It's torture. So yes.
But you like that though, right?
Yes. That's why I threw out that reluctant yes. It's fucking torture.
That's what anyone who's written a book says, by the way.
But I like challenging myself. I think that I like challenging myself. Just like I said, my friend went to the meditation retreat when she was done. She called me. She's like, I cried 4 days straight. I'm like, yeah. Writing this book was so incredibly hard. It took me little over 3 years to do it. And it is journaling. It is. It is. And it's, it reminds me of graduate school. Like, had I known what graduate school was going to be, I got my master's in clinical psychology. Had I known how hard that was going to be, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I'm glad that I did it. And writing this book, I knew it was going to be hard. And that's why I did it. I had a girlfriend say to me at the beginning of me writing, she said to me, only 3% of the people who start books actually finish them. And I'm like, I will be that 3%. And I'm so glad I did it and so incredibly proud of myself for doing it, but it was so hard. And a part of it that was harder than I expected was the book. Each chapter is a different relationship dynamic, and the chapters are broken up into parts. The first half is stories that I've solicited from people in my circle. How did you handle your mother when when you were growing up, she was a narcissist. When you were growing up, your father was an alcoholic or he wasn't around. How did you handle that? And people gave me their stories. Second half of the chapter are stories of me working with my clients and how I helped them get through similar things. I recorded the audio version of the book myself. That was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my entire life. And there's the technical part of it, but the other part of it was reading out loud these stories. It's very different reading in your head than it is reading out loud. It's very different. Very different. And an intervention that I have with a lot of my clients whenever they're trying to work something out with someone who either is dead or is just gone is let's write a letter to them. Write the letter, because that's a huge level of processing. Just getting something out of your head and whether it's pen to paper or typing it out, you're making sense of it. And then you're trying to articulate it so that someone else can understand it. That's so important and so incredibly hard and very, very cathartic. Then reading it out loud takes it to a whole new level. It makes it real. It makes it even more real. And so I was recording this book and I was just gutted and emotional. I couldn't sleep. And it's like, I've been working on this crap for years. I've been writing on this for years. Why is this level so hard? Because it's coming out. It's out loud. And I'm thinking of all the people that I know, my clients and my friends that submitted stories and what they went through and how hard it was for them to write this and share it with the world. And I was humbled by it. And it's so incredibly validating. It's so validating to go, yeah, that happened to me. And I'm still standing. Writing is so powerful.
I appreciate you sharing what part of it was so challenging, because you always hear, like, anyone who's written a book be like, it was such a hard project, so hard to do. So I appreciate you kind of diving into like the various aspects and the nuances of like this specifically was what was so hard. And I loved what you said about how speaking it out loud is the most challenging thing. And I think this is one of the reasons why talk therapy is so effective. And this is some other podcast I was listening to recently. I think it was a neuroscientist was talking about people who like think about stuff all day. They're like, well, I'm already thinking about it. Like, how much more am I going to be able to process it if I write it down? Writing it down, different part of the brain. Speaking it, totally different part of the brain. And like just working through those aspects of thinking, writing, speaking can be vastly different in the outcomes you're going to get and the sort of the catharsis you might feel or the processing you're going to get behind something. So it seems like, well, everything I wrote, I've already been thinking, and then saying it out loud, it's like, it's already been written down in my journal or I've been thinking about it for years. How much different is going to be? It can be massively different. Yeah. Which it seems like such a tiny thing, but one of the reasons why talk therapy is so effective. You said your word for the year was uncomfortable. Was that 2023? Can you share your word of the year for 2024 if you have it already?
I haven't figured it out yet. I heard someone say a word that I thought was really great. It was unavailable. It was either available or unavailable. And I thought, that's really interesting. It's like, what are you going to be available for? What are you going to be unavailable for? It may be available. I'm available for abundance. I'm available for love. I'm available for adventure. I'm not available for lack and for confusion and what, I don't know. I'm still formulating it, but it's going to be yet something else that challenges me. Being uncomfortable, anytime I wanted to say, no, I'm not going to do something, my brain would go, wait a minute. You said you were going to be uncomfortable this year. Wait a minute. And it's like, oh shit. All right, here we go. So I haven't figured out what the word is going to be yet. Have you thought about what your word could be?
I did. I have never even thought of a word. Last year, or 2023, I decided to run 1,000 miles, and I just crossed that yesterday. So this is December 29th that we're recording this. So I didn't have a word or anything, but maybe consistency.
Wow. That's amazing. Congratulations. Some concept.
Thank you. Some concept of like the small steps actually do add up, because it's like, I ran 3 miles on January 1st last year. I'm like, I'm literally no closer to my goal, but you just have to do that almost every single day. So no, I don't have a word for 2024 yet, but maybe before I release this, I'll reach back out and I'll have a word by then, and I'll find out what your word is as well. And then we can update sort of the show notes for this episode. I think that'd be a cool thing to do.
I can dig it.
The last thing I want to close out with is your motto is each one, teach one. Share what you learn in order to lighten the load of those around you. So what is one final point you'd like to share and teach the audience today before I let you go?
Put me on the spot. Share your healing journey. Share the highs and the lows of it. And that will help other people know that they can heal too. And you know, healing's not linear. It doesn't look pretty, and that's okay. But share your journey.
I think that's a great message. And in the spirit of that, I'll share that kind of doing this podcast has been such a, like, I love talking about health and getting to connect with people, but like, this is purely just like a therapeutic thing at this point. I'm realizing, I think you're going to be episode 16 or 17. And I'm like, I'm just realizing, I'm like, I love doing this for so many reasons, but I'm like, just being present and just connecting with even strangers over the internet is just, it's been a very cathartic and powerful thing for me. And it's definitely something I'd be sharing more about, kind of over the next year as well. So in the spirit of that, I will share that at least with the audience. So,
I appreciate that.
Melody, this has been a pleasure.
Bear witness.
Yeah, you've been a great guest. I think you had so many great insights to share. And it's really been a pleasure having you on. So all I can say
thank
is
you, Parker.
Thank you so much.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Hey everyone, that's all for today's show. I want to thank you so much for stopping by and watching, especially if you've made it all the way to this point. If you'd like to be notified when new episodes are going to be released, feel free to subscribe and make sure you hit the bell button as well. To learn more about today's guest, feel free to look in the description. You can also visit the podcast website, which is exploringhealthpodcast.com. That website will also be linked in the description. As always, likes, shares, comments are a huge help to me and to this channel and to the show. So any of that you can do, I would really appreciate. And again, thank you so much for watching. I'll see you next time.